This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 25th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today John Swartz. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing, Gary?
Good. John is a reporter for USA Today covering computer security and technology. He joined USA Today in 2000 to cover Apple. He spent almost 20 years reporting for Communications Week, Mac User UK, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Together with Brian Aquito, John wrote Zero Day Threat, which was just released at RSA and is moving up the Amazon food chain as we speak. Also, I just got word that John won a prestigious award today, along with Alan Sloan, interestingly enough. Congratulations on that, John.
Thank you.
I met John at the release party for the movie The New Face of Cybercrime when we were both included, which we were both in. And John graduated in journalism from San Jose State in 1983 and was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in 1997. So you are a prolific writer.
Yeah, it's been a long time. 20 years sometimes feel like dog years. But I was going to mention I also worked at Forbes.com during the dot-com craze.
Oh, interesting. You file about
last long, though.
I guess you file about three stories a week now. Do you ever feel like you're repeating yourself, or are things evolving so fast on the tech front that they stay interesting?
I think you're right on both counts. I mean, on one hand, it's always new, especially security. It always is evolving. For instance, we wrote a book called Zero Day Threat, but now I'm hearing of something called a Minus Day Threat, which I'm trying to figure out. on the flip side, yeah, you're right. It does feel sometimes like deja vu or Groundhog's Day when you do work in a newspaper. It seems as if sometimes you're writing the same story over and over again. That's one of the edicts in newspaper business is you have to assume that no one has read your story before, so you have to trot out some of the same material but rewrite it or recast it at times.
Uh-huh.
So you're right on both counts.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So you've been on the net since 1997. Is that when you first started using the net? The net beat you've been doing.
Yeah,
since
you know what? Actually, when I was at the San Francisco Chronicle, I was hired to cover Apple back then, during the Gil Amelio years.
Oh, yes.
Before Steve Jobs came back to save the company. And in the process, I kind of got a Apple burnout. I was writing almost constantly about that company. I wrote maybe 200 stories in 1996 about Apple. So my editor at the time, who's still at the Chronicle, said to me, "You should start writing more about the internet. We really don't have anyone covering that."
Oh, very cool.
So that led me to be nominated in 97 for a Pulitzer by the paper. And I was just going to mention, not to be a braggart, but given the last 5 years that Byron and I have been working on security for our paper, the paper's nominated us twice for security coverage for the Pulitzer. I mean, it's a long shot, but it's a nice pat on the back from the powers that be here.
It really is, and I think it shows the increasing importance of security as a domain that has that should have very wide interest.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's quite phenomenal. I mean, you have such good people in the field like Brian Krebs and Bob Sullivan at the Washington Post and MSNBC, respectively, who do nothing but cover security through their websites and through their other endeavors. We've pushed hard to do this for 5 years because it's an incredibly complicated field that constantly needs research and nurturing. Once you think you have a grasp on what's going on, then you realize, you know, there are new attack vectors, there are new scams, there are vendors who do good jobs and who don't do good jobs, and it's just evolving jigsaw puzzle that you keep trying to put back together, and once you do, it breaks up again.
So after a decade of covering this space, what do you think? Is global business doing enough today to manage security risks?
I think in some cases it is. For the most part, no. And what is kind of galling to me, actually, after a while, is during the process of researching and writing this book, you came across this consistent mantra that the consumer is somehow to blame for making silly mistakes.
Right.
It's always a shift, in whether it's security or airlines or insurance companies, what have you. The onus is always put on the poor consumer who's at the end of the food chain, rather than sometimes the security that should be there in the first place among, say, for instance, regional banks.
So I guess we sort of need a Ralph Nader for security, huh?
We have.
I hesitate to say that.
We don't have one, do we?
In an election year.
We're trying to be a watchdog in some cases, but sometimes it's hard to reach through, cut through the clutter. I mean, there was this big hue and cry when the debit cards for the members of the Senate went missing, the information for those cards, and there was a lot of saber-rattling from Washington, D.C. about some form of legislation. Well, it turns out they lost interest in the topic because John Roberts was being considered for the Supreme Court. They shifted their interest. I mean, that probably created more headlines. But in the interim, since then, we've seen the TJX breach, which I'm almost convinced, Gary, that there is actually a breach that's going on now. Maybe it's not as big as TJX, but it's probably on a par. And we probably won't hear about it for several months.
Yeah, that's right.
It goes on constantly.
I think it does. In fact, perhaps we should make a list of those people whose identities have not been compromised and then publish that and get it over with.
Yeah, every day it seems as if the LA Times, for instance, recently, there's a Farrah Fawcett breach. There's rumor George Clooney when he got hurt on the motorcycle.
Farrah Fawcett's still alive. Wow.
Maria Shriver. That was a couple of days ago. Passport files for the three presidential candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I just filed to renew my passport. It made me a little paranoid.
Oh, you can get one of those RFID passports.
Yeah, exactly. I talked to the guy from Germany who was the big proponent of that at Black Hat last year.
Yeah, and you've heard about some of the crazy ideas, like set off a bomb only when 50 American passports are within range.
It's incredible. It's crazy. Yeah. You know, when we talk about ID theft and all this vast amount of digital information out there, eventually, when it does end up in the wrong hands, everyone just thinks that they're going to use our credit card numbers and maybe create fake identities to sell to other people. But increasingly, I'm hearing from people in the State Department that there is a real concern that some of that information might end up being used to create fake passports for people to cross into the United States.
Of course.
And, it's just that I think is the ultimate treasure trove for this information.
So I've written both good guy books like Software Security and bad guy books like Exploiting Online Games, and the numbers show that the bad guy books outsell the good guy books about 4-1. And I think this is due to what I call the NASCAR effect. You know, there are several NASCAR channels on cable, but there's no Volvo car safety channel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we're doomed to tell sexy stories that sell and never actually fix the problem?
Yeah, I think that, unfortunately, I think you might be right. But, you know, the other thing is these books that sell on the bad guys, there's a reason why they sell, because there's so many victims and because there are more bad guys than good guys out there, it seems. I'm talking about, again, law enforcement versus the thousands of
criminals
folks out there, from the small-scale criminal to the organized crime entity overseas, or, for that matter, organized crime in the U.S. that are tapping into cybercrime. It's such a huge evolving problem. Every time I think that there is going to be the quote-unquote, and you've heard this, the digital Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my eyes roll whenever I hear that phrase now, because invariably the problem keeps getting bigger and bigger. At the RSA conference out here in San Francisco last week, the latest estimate on the size of cybercrime, a couple of years ago the FBI said it was $60 billion. That was their best guess.
Mm-hmm.
Now the estimates reached the $200 billion mark.
Yeah, that's not surprising. But I think the most interesting thing about those numbers are the trend in the numbers rather than the numbers themselves. Because it's kind of like pulling numbers out of thin air. But we do know that it's probably doubled and a little bit more, which is the interesting part.
Yeah, it's always hard to get an accurate number on instances of ID theft. You know, you hear these different estimates. The FTC had one that took several years to come out. Aviva LaTonne at Gartner Research has a figure of 15 million, and then you have other figures that downplay the problem, but then again, those are the researchers that are paid for by the financial institutions that they write about.
Yep. So, speaking of sexy stories that sell, your new book, Zero Day Threat, which, by the way, in hacker parlance would be O-Day Threat, just came out, and congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. That was a lot of work.
What is the take-home message of the book, you think?
The take-home message of the book is there's several things. First, what we want to do is we want to explain to people how all this cybercrime and ID theft and all these stories that they read about, how they all kind of fit together. How, for instance, as you know, how hacking had evolved from a hobbyist activity to a for-profit motive, and going back to Sasser, the Sasser worm.
Mm-hmm.
What we also want to do is we want to point out that banks, merchants, media companies, and tech companies are completely committed to porting commerce wholesale to the net, yet the Internet was never intended to be a secure transactions network. And the deeper corporate America embraces Web 2.0, the more doors and windows it's opening for very focused, profit-minded crime groups to exploit.
Well, I think in that case, what's happening is you're distributing the architecture of your application across trust boundaries.
Right.
In an interesting way.
Actually, you know, one other thing mentioned is it's kind of evolution among exploiting people's trust.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Bank of America has done a good job to shore up their security, as has Wells Fargo and others, Microsoft in particular. Those companies were exploited by the crooks. Now it looks as if the crooks are moving more toward other trustworthy types of applications or websites like Google, where
mm-hmm.
we see exploitation of Orkut and the calendar feature, the
mm-hmm.
search itself. You see Facebook and MySpace increasingly, you know, there'll be links that'll be posted on FunWall.
Yeah, the iframe attacks and all that.
The iframe attacks.
Yep.
And we see, you know, chinks and maybe in the iPhone, the attempts to exploit the iPhone, which would be the mother load of information, right? You have your PC, your cell phone, and your browser all in one application.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all kind of drifting among one another and moving and evolving into, you know, they're going downstream. And then, one thing we always come to the conclusion is if you set up any type of alarm system or any type of obstacle to a criminal, they'll go to the easier victim.
Well, plus, you know, there's a great technique that any hacker that's any good at all uses, which is set off the alarms over here and then
right.
perpetrate the crime over there. So I like one of the aspects of the book that's really cool is the neat kind of storytelling way that you do it. And there are a lot of really cool stories in the book, but I was hoping you might tell us about one of the coolest ones. Which one do you think is the coolest?
Well, I was the guy who would go out in the field and talk to the victims, befriend them. So that was my bailiwick.
Yeah.
Byron was the conceptual whiteboard guy who kind of saw this from 37,000 feet above. I was the guy usually in the trenches.
Did you have to meet some of these criminals?
I would communicate with them. Yeah, uh-huh. Sure. Some of them, including the guy who was the mule of the group in Florida, was talking to me off and on from prison. His name is Irving Escobar.
Yeah, you didn't out anybody through photos like Brian did you?
We did have photos, actually, yeah. We had some photos of surveillance photos of these guys committing crimes from investigators in Florida.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the Florida case to me was interesting because it runs the gamut of how these operations work. You have the guys on the ground level who have no idea who they're working with.
Right.
You know, somehow they get recruited to cash out after a series of transactions from the actual theft of the data down to the people on the street who use the credit card numbers
mm-hmm.
to purchase gift cards from the Walmart in Florida,
mm-hmm.
several places in Florida. I went to Gainesville. I was in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to the stores where these guys would ring up $20,000.
That seems to be a common place for doing that. I remember the TJX
yep.
guys were down there, too.
Yeah, the TJX guys, yeah, there was a ring led by this guy Escobar. They bought, you know, gift cards and merchandise worth probably about $2 million, and that's a conservative estimate.
Right.
The prosecutors told me it was much higher, but they prosecuted their case based on the most easily prosecutable information. So they said that the conservative figure was about $2 million. It was amazing to me, though, is that then I would call the victims, the credit card holders whose information had been breached.
Right.
Usually, invariably, they were retired people in Southern California who'd never shopped at Walmart.
Right.
And in some cases had never been to Florida. So, to me, this screamed out, how in the world
did where'd
this
that
happen?
Come
Why
from?
Wasn't this picked up by Visa and or Bank of America,
yeah.
whose credit card numbers were being exploited? I mean, we have people having $20,000 charged to their credit card account in one day from one location.
Yeah, you'd think
that
would set off those anomaly detectors, huh?
You would think so. And you know, I think Visa, in a sense, was accurate. They told us that, yes, you know, they have this, they have a detection of this, and then they pass that information on to the banks, and it's the bank's responsibility to contact their customers. Well, in the case of a lot of the victims in TJX, they were contacted 2 days later, not the day of the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would call B of A for an explanation, they would invariably, and I, again, this is from years of experience, mm-hmm. they would cite confidentiality agreements with their customers.
Right.
And I always beg to differ. I said, well, I just talked to your customer who gave me all their paperwork in front of me. I'm not reaching their confidence.
You know, the thing they do to their credit is that they seem to manage risk to within 9 basis points so that they can write off that fraud. And you know, you might have your identity stolen, you might have your credit card taken away and used, but you usually don't have to pony up any cash for that.
Right. I think the merchants always take the financial blow on that angle.
Right.
In this case, it'd be Walmart. Uh-huh. But they're, it was interesting. I was talking to Steve Ballmer for this book. I was at the Vista launch, and I had an interview with him, but I started asking him about acceptable losses, and he had an interesting analogy, which has probably been used before, but regardless, he says, you know, in a sense, the Internet's was not built with security in mind,
mm-hmm.
and it was built like a freeway system, and people, meaning companies, can travel fast on that. They can maximize their profits. It's more convenient for consumers. There's a quicker way of doing business. The profit is there. He said, eventually, though, we'll reach a stage like Microsoft did where the acceptable losses are no longer acceptable, and you're going to have to tighten up security. And in a lot of cases, we still haven't reached that point yet.
I think that's right. But I also think that we're at this interesting point in history, which you can see with other technologies like the telephone. If you look at reporting back from when the telephone was first introduced, you would see stories about telephone murder or telephone bank robbery, which just meant that somebody had used the telephone as a tool during the murder, maybe to call the victim and have them come over. And I think there's a little bit of that effect these days, too, because crime has always been with us, and this just happens to be the tool of the day.
Yeah, you know, Shelley, boiling down with, you know, one of the goals, you know, of our book is to show how the cybercrime economy is driven by capitalist principles and entrepreneurship. I mean, in a sense, if you look at what happened with TJX or even with ChoicePoint, you basically have these enterprising criminals who delegate tasks and authority among one another.
Mm-hmm.
They come together. They start basically a startup, and they disband it when the heat really picks up.
Yeah.
Shadow Crew, I guess, had several thousand people involved, although only a handful were prosecuted. And after that was busted up, you see 12 iterations of Shadow Crew surface.
So do you think there are any lessons for software security engineers that are hidden in your book?
That's a good question. I mean, there's always a debate. Remember on our panel in New York for the cybercrime documentary,
mm-hmm.
Ted Schlein over at Kleiner Perkins, former executive at Symantec, mentioned certification of software, which is the ongoing debate. And I'm hearing more of that. There's kind of a shifting onus to the developers themselves. I mean, Microsoft criticizes they did pass the edict to shore up their security. And we're seeing with Symantec's reports on cybercrime and hacking that, in a sense, Mozilla actually is becoming more of a target, as is Facebook. I mean, there have been more reported instances that have been discovered than before. So I sense, there is more of a pressure on those folks.
It's just sort of yet another reason that we have to do this. Because I think the onus is on software people to solve the problem. And that for so long we've been focusing on trying to block criminals from our protected systems with network stuff. That clearly hasn't worked. That we've had to move inside the systems themselves to how they're designed and built.
You know, I wish I actually, the more I think about this, I wish I had more positive news, but I think so much of our sensitive data has been harvested, it's mine.
So here's a question that might sound familiar to you, because you asked it to Symantec's CEO recently. And here it is. Why is it that despite a string of highly publicized breaches at TJX and the Veterans Administration, among others, that the general public has such a lax attitude towards computer security?
You know, almost with every topic, and I hate to sound as if I'm speaking on behalf of the American public, but until somebody's victimized, it's just out of sight, out of mind. It's amazing. I mean, if spam wasn't effective or phishing wasn't effective, we still wouldn't be seeing it in record numbers. Just there's not enough of an education of the public, but sometimes you wonder, do you have to educate the public in the way that, say, the auto industry was educated by Ralph Nader? I mean, you need that one set of figures you mentioned. I don't see one. I think Richard Clark has tried, but to a lesser extent. I mean, his focus is a little bit more on national security.
That's right.
I think Gates was engaged for a while, but once he decided to shift into philanthropy, I think he lost interest, or he just had to change his focus. And I think it's a noble focus that he shifted to.
Uh-huh.
I give him all the credit in the world, but I don't really think there's a central figure. I think when we see some of the CEOs or hear from some of the CEOs of security companies, many of them speak in platitudes and don't.
Well, I don't think those guys understand the software security problem, frankly.
Yeah, there's several layers removed from what's happening on the ground level. Yeah. It's almost prefer to talk to the engineers and those people.
Yeah, so I've been evangelizing for software security for about a decade.
Yeah,
It hasn't been that successful, frankly.
It
certainly made some difference, because back in the old days, I used to say software security, and people would look at me like a cow looks at a new gate. But now they look at me in a worried way, like a 30-year-old contemplating retirement. So what can we do to boil down software security messaging enough to get normal people to understand it? I mean, that's to some extent your job.
That's what I'm hoping the book does. I mean, I hope it reaches a wide enough audience to do that. We've been doing a lot of radio interviews. And, you know, I do give listeners on radio stations in particular credit. I was on a local radio show in San Francisco, which is the top-rated radio station. I was on it's a popular show for about an hour, and they got tons of calls, and almost everyone who called in was aware of security in one way or another, and they knew they had to update their antivirus program, they needed a firewall, they knew they had to be paranoid about email attachments, they wouldn't open them unless they were absolutely certain that they were legitimate. A lot of them weren't aware of some of the new vectors, such as their own Facebook profile, which is a little terrifying.
How about the online game stuff? I don't know.
That's another one. They mentioned, a lot of them mentioned that. So, I mean, in a sense, it's filtering out. But it still astounds me, given the breadth of coverage of this, how it tends to be overlooked. I mean, one of the things we decided to do with this book is write a tech crime thriller type
right.
of book. From various
and it is that it's
like,
very
like traffic, like the
very
movie Traffic.
Readable. Yeah,
yeah. We're trying to write it like approaching this like the movie Traffic. You have multiple narrative of a problem, and there is a parallel between this and the drug industry in that if it doesn't touch you directly, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
Or even like the environment. You know, everyone talked about the carbon footprint. We were trying to establish some idea of a digital footprint. You know, before it really has major implications, if not already on economic systems or people's trust in shopping and searching online. It is though, Gary. I mean, I really don't know how you can really resonate with the wide stream public unless there is some sort of incredible event that takes place.
Yeah.
And so far,
even then, it's tricky because I'm a computer scientist, as you know, and a software security guy, and yet when I go to my little county to a cocktail party at somebody's house, even pretty well-informed intellectuals, they think, oh, you're a computer guy. Gee, can you help me with my home PC problem? That's the state of the real wide world out there. And you just sort of go, that's not the kind of computer guy I am.
Well, given, if I were a criminal, I mean, this is probably terrible to say, but if I was a criminal, I couldn't think of a better crime to commit because it's basically free money. You're not.
Yeah, I know.
The infrastructure costs are minimal.
That's absolutely right.
There's no threat of violence.
What is it that the guy from the San Jose paper said in the movie that was so funny?
Oh yeah, he talked about the Sopranos. I mean, if they were getting into new business, this would be it. I mean, look, think about it though, because you have this, you know, arguably $200 billion a year industry where you have script kiddies and novice scammers kind of splashing in the shallows, mm-hmm. grabbing law enforcement attention.
Mm-hmm.
But out in the deeper running water, you have the elite hackers mm-hmm. creating zero-day viruses, running massive botnets like Storm, operating bulletproof hosting services like Russian Business Network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big guys kind of operate, as Dean Takahashi said, like Al Capone at the height of the Prohibition. There's
right.
no Iliad nests, you know, on the horizon to slow them down, as far as I can see.
Right.
I mean, there was a bit of an effort within the FBI to make cybercrime a top priority, but I don't think they had the resources, the people, or the know-how to make much of a dent. And I don't think they
I think
wouldn't
that's
say
right.
that publicly, but I think privately they would acknowledge it.
Oh, I think they would. Everybody I've talked to over there, especially the know-how part.
Okay.
So, excellent. Thanks a lot. This has been really, really interesting. I got one last question for you.
Sure.
Do you secretly wish you were a lawyer still?
I always wanted to be one, but yeah, that would be kind of interesting. Yeah,
that's what they say. That's the kind of stuff you can dig up on you out there.
Okay, there you go.
Thanks for your time.
All right, thanks a lot.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The May-June 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine is a special issue on electronic voting, edited by Avi Rubin and David Jefferson. The magazine just sponsored a panel on e-voting security at RSA that was highly regarded. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where Silver Bullet excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.